You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is NPR News. I'm Mike Edgerly, sitting in today for Carrie Miller. By any measure, Carol Henderson has had an extraordinary career. He has held, formerly, only two positions at the Minnesota DNR since he started at the Lacqui-Parle Wildlife Management Area in 1974. In 1977, he founded and ran the Noun Game Wildlife Program. He's been there ever since. Now Carol is planning to retire after 44 years at the DNR. Let's do a very overly simplified summary of Carol Henderson's career, and then we'll dig in a little bit. Carol's work has led to protection and recovery for threatened species of birds, both in Minnesota and other states. He's written numerous articles and books on wildlife, is an accomplished photographer whose work even led to protections for a migratory species of whale and a birder with a life list that's somewhere around 3,000 species. But perhaps most significantly of all, for Minnesota, he's been the driving force behind the non-game wildlife checkoff that appears on our state income tax forms. We call it the Chickadee Checkoff. It's raised more than $35 million for non-game wildlife since it became law in 1981. That checkoff is a legacy that will live on long after Carol Henderson steps down. Carol Henderson is in our studio this morning for an NPR News exit interview, the official interview. Carol, thank you for coming in, and it's good to see you.
Thank you very much, Mike.
And we want to hear from you today. Are you an outdoor birding enthusiast? Have you come close to 3,000 species on your birds on your life list? Do you have a question about wildlife changes you've seen in your own backyard or questions about feeding birds? That's a passion close to Carol's heart as well. Carol, if you don't mind, I want to take you back in time.
Okay.
And you didn't know I was going to ask you about this, but I'm going to take you back in time. Tell us about the hummingbird story. There was this item, this thing that appeared on fences for several decades, and you discovered it was a threat to hummingbirds.
Right. There used to be a little red insulator that you would snap onto a steel fence post for electric fences. And we got a call from up in the Pine County area that farmers were finding dead hummingbirds hanging by their feet right next to these insulators. And what we discovered that it was in a relatively dry fall, the hummingbirds were attracted to the red color. They would land on the wire for the electric fence and then start probing the insulator looking for nectar, thinking it was a flower. And then if their bill touched the steel fence post, they got electrocuted. And so we put out some news releases saying, let us know if you find this problem, if it's more widespread. And we started getting reports from as far away as Missouri that, yes, the birds were migrating in a dry fall, and they were finding them electrocuted throughout the entire Midwest on these little horse pastures and pastures where these red snapper insulators were being used. And then we discovered that the manufacturer was right here from in the Twin Cities. And we contacted them, and you know, and they marketed these red snappers worldwide, many, many countries. And we realized that this was not just a threat to our ruby-throated hummingbirds, but to hummingbirds in the tropics and who knows where. So we asked if it would be possible to change it to a neutral color that's not attractive to the hummingbirds, and we suggested black. And they said, well, the name of our insulator is the Red Snapper. Well, the owner of the company got a call from, a letter from someone down in Ohio, I guess, saying, he was impaired. He couldn't get out anymore. The only thing he had left in the world was watching the hummingbirds out of his window. And he said, and now you're going to kill him off. And it just got him right in the heart. He couldn't handle that kind of emotional thought of taking away something from people that they cared about. And so he changed the red snappers to black and began manufacturing and distributing them. And then we subsequently gave him a conservation award for his work.
Wow, that's an incredible story. And who knows how many birds were saved because of that discovery and your actions to convince the maker of those things to change the color.
Right. And so you have to walk a line between wanting to do something for wildlife, but you have to appreciate the industry perspective of, you know, any minor change that we think is a minor change for them is a big change when it's right. when you're looking at the colors and the manufacturing and marketing of their insulator that had been popular for so many years.
And has that thinking informed your work over these years, 44 years?
Yeah, conservation is not something where you can be just narrowly focused on the birds or the animals. You have to look at the big picture of, you know, like in wildlife tourism, you're working with people in chambers of commerce and tourism bureaus and people who are looking to bring people into their area for the benefit of enjoying the wildlife. In fact, next Tuesday, we're having a meeting up in Grand Rapids to work on a proposal for what we're calling the Heart of the Bog Birding and Wildlife Trail that would extend essentially from Duluth to Bemidji and then north to the Canadian border, where we would pick out some of the very best places to see some of our far northern wildlife, especially from the lowland tamarack, lowland conifer forests. Mm-hmm. And people will come from all over the United States to see birds like the spruce grouse, the Connecticut warbler, and some of these other species that are very unique, boreal chickadee, in that area. And there are many nature photographers who will bring workshops to that part of Minnesota if we can highlight where they are and get them to these areas in a relatively easy and safe manner.
Wow. That must be a really big difference from when you started to work at L'Aquaparle back in the 70s. The idea that birds and other critters would actually be an attractor for tourists to come to Minnesota.
Right. At that point, the big attraction was a hunting attraction. And I worked with on the L'Aquaparle Wildlife Refuge where deer hunting and goose hunting and duck hunting, pheasant hunting were all big draws. And now that area is also very popular for birding as well.
Right. Carol Henderson is our guest in this hour of NPR News. He's retiring after more than four decades at the Minnesota DNR. You can join our conversation at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or 1-800-242-2828, 1-800-242-2828. Carol, I'd like to ask you about another phenomenon, and it does have commercial implications, and this is the idea of lead shot that hunters use. Well, at one point they were using it for waterfowling, but it's still used in deer hunting,
right.
and it's quite prevalent in fishing tackle.
Right.
I take it that's not as simple as convincing someone to no longer use red in a little snapper on a fence.
Yeah, we're no longer working with an audience of one. and like with deer hunting, we're looking at 500,000 deer hunters in the state, and many of them have hunted for decades. And I've been a deer hunter myself, so I appreciate the tradition and the fact that, you know, for there are a lot of natural habitats that need deer hunting to help keep the deer populations at a manageable level. But what we have discovered is that we have become so complacent and accepting of lead as a bullet that we don't think of the consequences of what happens after we take our deer and leave the woods. But we have probably at least 30 eagles or more every year that die as a result of eating what the hunters leave in the woods, the entrails.
Now, explain how that works. So
when a bullet hits a deer, it might rifle bullet or even shotgun slug, they fragment. And the higher velocity rifle bullets will fragment into little tiny microscopic pieces and even lead dust. And that will penetrate into the muscle tissue up to 14 inches away from the wound channel. And it also will enter the entrails, the gut pile.
Mm-hmm.
So the hunter leaves the gut pile in the woods, and then within hours sometimes, it will be entirely consumed by bald eagles and ravens and hawks that are looking at that as a free meal. And that's where we get this die-off occurring during and after the deer season. And it's totally unnecessary because nowadays, non-toxic copper ammo and other composite materials are available, and they're just as cheap as the lead bullets, and they actually penetrate better, and they perform it equally as well, or sometimes people think better than the lead bullets. And so and they're easily accessible. You can order them online. You can buy them at all the major sporting goods stores. And anything we can do to reduce spreading lead in the environment is a good thing.
Right.
And so we're looking, and then we also found out a dramatic thing this past year. The Department of Agriculture has to test all of the venison that's donated to food shelves by deer hunters. And they donate, you know, hundreds of deer every year to the food shelves. Well, they have to take all those packages and x-ray them for lead fragments. And over the last 5 or 6 years, they found that it averages about 14 to 15% of all the packages have to be destroyed because they've got lead.
So there's not just the risk to the raptors,
right,
who feed on the remains left behind after a deer is cleaned, but humans.
Right.
And so there is a risk of human consumption.
Right. So my initial concern as a wildlife biologist is, well, we shouldn't be poisoning eagles. That should be a no-brainer. And then we started looking at this other supplemental information, and it's like, well, you know what? We shouldn't be eating lead either.
Right.
And if 14 to 15% of the venison that hunters keep and feed their families and friends, if that also has lead and they don't realize it, well, last year, hunters took about 200,000 deer in Minnesota.
Right.
And if they get 40 pounds of venison per deer, that's about 8 million pounds of venison. That's a lot of supposedly really good, healthful meat. But if you take 14 or 15% of that and assume it's the same percentage as what's being donated to the food shelves, that's 1.2 million pounds of contaminated, lead-contaminated venison that people are eating. And that is, you know, it can affect cognitive abilities in older adults. It can affect IQ in children. We need to let people know that the family needs to be involved in what choice of bullets you're using, because we don't want people eating lead if it's going to affect them on a lifetime basis.
Are you making any headway on changing thinking about that?
Yes, we've been working with the Minnesota chapter of the Wildlife Society and also with conservation groups like Minnesota Conservation Federation, Three Rivers Parks, and other conservation partners. We've had lead roundtables or copper roundtables over the past several years to let people know what's the latest technology and the availability of the ammunition. We've been in constant contact with Federal Cartridge to find out what their latest information is on the availability and the performance of this ammunition. And it's a matter of just slowly changing attitudes, saying, you know, this isn't about anti-hunting. It's just about a change in technology. It's like archers went through years ago where they changed from recurve bows to compound bows. They're still hunting. They're still bringing home deer. It's just a different technique.
Right. This is probably a familiar situation to you from your career, right? There has been this, over the four decades you've done this work, you've had to convince people about something.
Right. And I've gone through the same transition because I was deer hunting with lead slugs when I hunted out at Lac qui Parle. And so I was one of those people using lead early on in my career. And also, I initiated that study back in about 1980 about the eagles that were dying at Lac qui Parle. And at that time, they were eating dead and dying geese that had lead not only shot into their bodies, but the geese were eating lead pellets out in the grain fields, swallowing them. And we picked up 300 dead geese. We x-rayed them, and many of the pellets were actually in the crops and the gizzards of the geese, and they were dying of lead poisoning. And then they were poisoning the eagles. And at that time, the eagle was federally listed. And there could have been an injunction to close all the goose hunting out there because it was affecting an endangered species. So that was when Roger Holmes and Joe Alexander took this information. They said, well, this isn't acceptable. We have to change this, you know, for many reasons, to protect the eagle, but also, you know, continue hunting.
Right.
And so that was when they announced several years in advance that Minnesota would switch to non-toxic ammunition for waterfowl hunting in 1987.
Right. Well, let's shift gears a little bit, but keep on with this idea of protected eagles. You helped other states repopulate with eagles, right?
Yes.
You exported some Minnesota raptors to other states.
Yes, we were a net exporter. We had a healthy growing population of eagles at a time that other states were just down to their last few pairs. So over about a 10-year period, we would capture up to 5 nestling eagles per year scattered across northern Minnesota. And we shipped off eagles to New York, to Georgia, Missouri, North Carolina, Arkansas. And all of those states then used, it was 55 eagles in all. And now those states have very healthy growing populations of bald eagles. And some of those are the Minnesota origin eagles that helped get their population started.
You can join our conversation with Carol Henderson at 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000, or 800-242-2828, 800-242-2828. If you're an outdoor birding enthusiast, you may have a question for Carol, and I bet he'll take your question and help you with your bird feeding and other questions. Talk to me just a bit about, let's go back to what we know as the chickadee checkoff.
Yes.
Which allows us to check a little box on our state income tax and send a donation in that goes to species like habitat for eagles and so forth and so on. How did that come about?
Oh, it's a wonderful story. we had a young woman, Diane Vosick, who worked for me as a Young Adult Conservation Corps employee for a year. So she knew what we were trying to accomplish, because then I was the only person in the program and she was my assistant. That was just the two of us. So she knew what we were trying to accomplish on a shoestring budget, because when I started, my budget for the whole year was $25,000 per year, and that included my salary. And so I was doing a lot with volunteers and on the road a lot, just talking to people, learn about what their concerns were. And after Diane left work at the DNR, she became an intern for then State Senator Colin Peterson. And Colin was in the Minnesota legislature on the tax committee at the end of April, and it was the last night of passing the omnibus tax bill. And the day before, and then on the day of that meeting, he saw two news releases coming out of Colorado that they had passed the previous year a checkoff on the state tax form for protected wildlife, the non-game species. And then when he saw the second news release, it kind of cemented the idea. This sounded like a good idea that Minnesota could use. So he got Diane to get the language for that bill, and he stuck it in his hip pocket, basically, and took it into that tax meeting at the legislature. And when they started amending the tax bill that night, he had the flexibility of introducing that to be passed. And the first few times that he brought it out, they said, oh, that's silly. That's just a chickadee checkoff. voted it down. But he kept bringing it up. And finally, maybe 2 to 3 in the morning, he pulled it out again when they were voting on another amendment. And they said, well, you're just going to keep introducing this until we pass it, aren't you? And he said, yes. So they passed it. And I literally woke up in the morning with a checkoff. And so our budget went from maybe $25,000 or $30,000 a year the next year to over $500,000.
And it was all voluntary.
And
there was nothing
voluntary.
And
it's still voluntary. And now what's wonderful about it is our donations are up to over $1 million a year. And the conservation license plates you see in Minnesota, those, all the money that comes to that, part of that can be used to match one-to-one the checkoff donation. So we get $1 million from citizens, and then that is matched also from the license plate revenue. And then also, if people list us in their estate planning, anything they donate on their estate planning will be matched by the license plate revenue.
Wow, that's crazy. That's quite a legacy, isn't it?
It is. It's exciting to see it grow from just one person, one little office, and now we've got people working throughout the state, and not just on birds, but on the whole array of birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, fishes, invertebrates, pollinators is now a big thing.
Right.
And all of this helps contribute to a much more holistic approach toward conservation than a lot of the single species management we've seen in the past.
Let's go to the phone. Ian in Minneapolis, you're on with Carol Henderson.
Hi, Carol. Hey, so first of all, thanks for sharing all this information for hunters and people that, you know, promote the outdoors and all that. So I'm a deer hunter, a grouse hunter, and a waterfowl hunter. And I have a question regarding the ammunition for lead and stuff.
Yes.
What do you suggest is a material we should use in our ammunition instead of lead? Or if I'm going into, you know, L&M Fleet or, you know, Cabela's or something like that, what should I be asking the people in the store saying, like, you know, I'm looking for this type of ammunition? Because I've heard of, like, what is it, nickel or,
yes,
you know, bisphalt?
Yes, there's tungsten and bismuth available for shot shell for hunting waterfowl, and you can also use that on upland game. In fact, a lot of people who hunt pheasants prefer using the non-toxic ammo, because if they see some ducks when they're out, it's legal both ways. And then if you're looking for something for deer hunting, the main ingredient is copper, and there also are some materials that are copper combinations that can be used. But I know Federal has gone to labeling their boxes, and sometimes really hard to tell on a box if it's non-toxic or not. But Federal has gone to labeling it so that it says all copper or non-toxic. And these are the ones that are the EagleSafe loads. And this is another thing where we have to work with the marketing because, you know, any little changes that we might think are insignificant, for the industry, it's a big deal to change over their labeling and so forth, or to change over their manufacturing. And we've had some people confused saying, well, my lead bullet has a copper jacket around it. Does that count? Well, no, it doesn't count because the copper is only to keep the lead together when it first hits the deer, but then the lead starts to shatter. And up to maybe half of that lead content in a bullet might shatter into tiny pieces that you'll never feel when you're eating it. So, you know, I think the clerks who work at some of these major stores, they're much more into this now because they see this is really the future. We're not going backwards on this. We're not going back to lead because it just has too many downsides. We've seen that with all the incidents relating to places like Flint, Michigan. If it's bad in our water, it's got to be bad in our venison too. So, and we need to involve our spouse in the selecting of ammunition so they realize that this is a safe material because the copper, for example, it retains like up over 98% of its form in hitting a deer. It doesn't shatter. And so look for the tungsten or bismuth in shot shells. Look for mainly the copper or the copper combinations. And also there are additional availability of slugs for shotguns or sabots even for muzzle loading that may be tin or other materials that will be quite effective.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. Jeff from Excelsior. You're on with Carol.
Good morning, Carol. Can you hear me?
Yes. Sure can.
I'm right in Excelsior right now on lunch break, but I've heard you up north. Actually, we have a place on Deer Lake, and you've come out and spoke with the association. So I'm very grateful for all of your efforts over your career. I do have one question, though. It just seems to be logical. Why isn't lead banned, regardless of what you're hunting there? I'm a grouse hunter. If there is an alternative, why isn't there legislation to ban lead?
That's a good question.
Well, it's a good one, and it's a political one. And so I'll just explain it as clear as I can, and you can take it for what it is. But there are... You know, it should be a no-brainer. And when you explain it one-to-one to somebody and say, well, this we don't want to affect your family and you're going to come home with just as many deer or whatever if you go to non-toxics, the NRA discourages the use of anything but lead. They're saying that if we change to non-toxic ammunition, it's a slippery slope toward banning all guns and threatens our Second Amendment. Well, it doesn't. It doesn't threaten anything because you're still hunting, you're still bringing home deer, and so the reasoning is well, shall we say, not a good conclusion to draw that if you're going to use copper, you're still going to come home with that deer, you're still going to come home with the animals you were pursuing. It's not a threat to the Second Amendment, and I strongly support protecting the Second Amendment. That's a wonderful piece of advocacy for our democracy, but it doesn't belong in this political discussion.
Let's go to Nancy from St. Louis Park. You're on with Carol.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for highlighting Carol Henderson's career. He is just a state treasure. The question I have, could Carol address the top three things that this state can do to sustain our non-game wildlife populations?
There you go, a simple question.
Well, the first thing we need to do is to recognize that our funding is always vulnerable in terms of having adequate funding to address big issues affecting habitat, contamination, and population recovery. And one of the things that's really big right now is that there is a new piece of legislation that has been introduced in both the House and Senate in Washington called RAWA, Restoring America's Wildlife Act. And right now there are over 80, 85 sponsors for this bill, and it's almost split evenly between Republicans and Democrats. And I think that's really wonderful in this particular era that we can get people agreeing on a plan for wildlife conservation. It would provide massive funding for every state, including Minnesota. using offshore oil revenues from the Gulf of Mexico. And other techniques have been suggested, but nothing survived the gauntlet in Washington. The oil revenues were proposed as far long ago as 20 years ago, but nothing has made it this far that it still works. So that was just introduced within the last month, and you need to look this up and let our congressional delegation, our senators know that this is where our future is, that we can talk about a lot of things we would like to do, but without the money behind it, things fall short.
Right.
So Restoring America's Wildlife Act, legislation in Congress, if we can get this to pass, it would be a phenomenal step into the future. And I think that's where we need to be. You know, I enjoy looking back. It's fun to reminisce, but we need to keep looking forward and what's coming next. And so, Nancy, your question is wonderful. The other thing is that we're facing some dramatic changes in how we interact with the outdoors and outdoor nature recreation. In the last 5 years, the number of people nationwide who have taken on nature recreation or wildlife photography, bird feeding, has gone up between 16 and 20%. And here are all these people who are all excited about the outdoors. They want to interact. They benefit from our state parks, but they also can benefit from how we manage everything from our backyards to our own private lands, whether they be forests or farms or whatever. And sometimes it's not that expensive, but you just need to know what the right techniques are. And so, you know, we look at the opportunities within our agencies to provide that kind of extension and outreach information. People want to know how they can help pollinators. Well, that's a wonderful avenue for promoting conservation right now. We need to push that. And then, like the meeting we've got next Tuesday, we'll connect with northern communities all through that northern region for wildlife recreation in areas where the other thing that's happening is that the number of people involved with hunting is declining. And in that last 5 years, when recreation for nature tourism was going up almost 20%, it went down almost 16 to 20% for hunting. Mm. And so if some of these communities that depend on a strong income from hunting activities and outdoor activities that are traditional, they need to latch on to this new rising star in our outdoor environment and say, we need to bring in some of these tourists who want to enjoy nature in the North Country. So, you know, we're going to be meeting at the DNR building 1 o'clock next Thursday or Tuesday afternoon to talk about putting together a coalition to help make that happen. And then we need to also keep promoting a cleaner environment for wildlife. And that's why my vision for reducing or eliminating use of lead, both in our fishing tackle and in our deer hunting ammo. It's not a criticism of hunters. That's what we've done. It's a way that we can have alternatives that are not contaminating the environment. And each time we see one of these opportunities, we need to advocate this and not point fingers, but to raise your hand and say, I'll help.
Yeah.
And it needs to be a coalition of people. And I think this is where one of our big opportunities is to bring people together. We need hunters, bird watchers, bird feeders, everyone to say we all have a shared interest in the environment. Bring those people together so that in the future they will have the amount of legislative clout and respectability that will make good changes for the future.
Right. Politics is woven through all of this.
Oh, it is.
And this is my politics question for you.
Okay.
How have you managed to survive all of these years through the various administrations, ups and downs in the economy, changes in party politics, and yet here you are. You've risen above it, and you're making your way and planning to retire. How did you do that without getting canned along the way?
Well,
to put it bluntly.
Well, there are two things. One is that bluebirds, bald eagles, trumpeter swans, they're neither Republicans or Democrats. These are native citizens. We need to look after them. We need to take care of them. And when you show people a good plan for conservation, everybody benefits. Business benefits, people benefit. And I get so many wonderful stories of people saying how every time they see a family of trumpeter swans, they're just so excited. And so there's a lot of very positive feedback. And the other thing is that whenever there's some challenge, like, you know, deer hunting and lead ammo, you have to look at the issue from every angle. From the angle of the hunter who has been using lead for 40 years, and from the 10-year-old who wants to go deer hunting for the first time. And I've been involved in giving presentations to the youth-mentored deer hunts at state parks. And when you explain the effects of lead and the reasons why we need to use non-toxic ammunition, those kids, they get it in an instant. They don't want to be feeding lead to their families if they shoot a deer with lead. And by the time the presentations are over, they're begging their parents, Dad, we got to go buy some copper bullets before I go deer hunting. And so, again, part of our conservation message needs to be focused on younger people because they're going to understand a lot of these environmental challenges much more quickly than we might anticipate.
Right. Well, you know, your resume and your list of accomplishments since you started at the DNR is probably big enough for five people. And I just have to ask, what do you see as your biggest accomplishment at the DNR?
Well,
or outside work for that matter.
Well, a couple of things. One would be, you know, putting together the plan, you know, with and obviously I don't do any of this stuff by myself. One of the first things that I do when I get one of these ideas is to put together a network of who are my partners. And that's what makes things work. The Trumpeter Swan would probably be the biggest achievement because we started with an idea and over about 20 years we turned loose about 370 swans and now we've got over 20,000 and they're just doing fantastic. I never would have thought we would have seen this kind of response just even within my own lifetime. And then the other story that was a big accomplishment and I had no idea of its significance at the time is that we were leading a birdwatching trip off the coast of Costa Rica. We were going out to a place called Caño Island and we encountered a group of six humpback whales. And being an Iowa farm boy, I knew nothing about whales. The only thing I knew is that their flukes on the humpbacks are different. Each like a fingerprint. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to photograph the fluke every time they surfaced, and I got four out of the six. And our guide said, you know, there's a question about these whales, because first of all, some people in Costa Rica, even the top-level biologists, don't believe we have whales. And then other people say, well, we don't know if these are whales coming from north that winter in the south where they have their calves right offshore from Costa Rica, or if they're coming from the southern hemisphere and having their calves here. So when we got back, I sent some photographs of my whale tails, my flukes, to the Cousteau Society out in Washington. And they have a registry of whale photos. And they matched two of my pictures with whales that had been photographed offshore from California. And that, so then this is part of a migratory population that goes down off the coast of Costa Rica to have their calves in the winter, or our winter. And I didn't know it at the time, but there were some local lodge owners who had been advocating for setting aside a national park in the Caño Island area for protecting the whales during their calving season. And they had gone into San Jose. They talked to the wildlife biologist in the wildlife department, and the biologist said, that's silly. Costa Rica doesn't have whales. So then they went to President Oscar Arias and gave their same proposal, saying we need to protect this area offshore in the Dominical area for the whales. And he says, okay, if you can prove, first of all, that there's a migratory population and this is where they come to have their calves and that there are whales there, we'll see what we can do. Well, then my photos arrive in the mail to those people, John Tresemer, who was advocating for the park. He drove those photos into San Jose, took them right to President Arias. He said, here's your proof. And he said, you have your park.
What a story.
That's 20 square miles was set aside for the whales based on those two pictures.
And you had no idea at the time.
I had no idea.
You were just an Iowa farm boy taking photos of whales.
Right. And the first time one of them reached, my only response as an Iowa farm boy is, my God, it's as big as a silo.
That's great. So that is quite an accomplishment. That is quite an accomplishment. Let's go back to the phones. Lima in Blaine, I hope I got your name right.
Yeah, that's correct. In your 40 years, what changes have you seen in Minnesota's ecosystems as a result of climate change?
Well, the climate change is a very, very difficult thing to see happening since it's typically a very slow process. In terms of species ranges extending, I think that's probably our best indicator, that we're seeing some species of more southerly birds that are extending their ranges northwards into Minnesota and farther into northern Minnesota. for example, cardinals, red-bellied woodpeckers, species like that. And then perhaps even more concerning, though, is that we have northern birds like the gray jay and the pine grosbeak and others whose ranges are receding slowly northwards toward the Canadian border. And so, and these are changes that are on such a grand scale that it's really difficult to turn things around on that scale. And one of the things that's interesting with loons, though, is that there has been concern about loons' ranges receding farther north. But we do have a system of what are called Cisco lakes, deep water Cisco lakes, about almost 200 of them in northern Minnesota that are extremely deep, 150 feet deep or deeper. And they have a big reservoir of very cold water. So some of these lakes would be much more resistant to climate change for some of the, our northern species like the loons than the very shallow lakes, which would tend to warm up more quickly over time. And so conservation efforts directed at the Cisco lakes is an important piece of the whole puzzle here in trying to protect that particular kind
It's a kind of a refuge or a last refuge.
It'll be the last refuge, yes.
I want to talk about loons. Earlier this century, we had a big oil spill in the Gulf, the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster, I guess it was. Books, movies made about it. It actually, the fallout from that, the oil spilled from that, apparently has an effect on loons migrating from Minnesota south. And what have you found out about that? The Minnesota has asked for relief,
yes,
I believe, from the funds set up as a result of that spill.
Right. We've done research over the last 7 years just looking at impacts that would relate to the loons. We've looked at contaminants that they carry in their bodies, in their blood, their feathers, on eggs that don't hatch. When people find a dead loon, we've had necropsies done looking at the contaminants in their fatty tissues. And that's the evidence that we have used. And then we've also done some wonderful work with the U.S. Geological Survey relating to migration, where we use both radio implants for satellite transmitters and also geolocators attached to their legs, so we can monitor their migratory paths and find out if they're wintering in the Gulf of Mexico where the oil spill was. And we did find out that, yes, they were going right to where this oil spill was. And we also found from the geolocators, which measure pressure, we can measure every time a loon dives to get fish, we know how deeply they go all winter long. It's incredible. They go to the bottom. They feed on the bottom in the Gulf, maybe 120, 30 feet deep. And that's where the crud would have settled. Mm-hmm. And so they were bringing back contaminants of the PAH contamination, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons.
I see.
Okay. And then they were passing those into the eggs they were laying too. So some of these are impacts that are very difficult to prove what it would do. It might affect lifespan or it could affect the reproductive capacity of the loons. This information has been shared with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and they're now developing a plan that may well be introduced within the next several weeks and published in the Federal Register. And then they will be looking for public comment on what people think about things that Minnesota could be doing. So I guess I would just tell people, stay tuned for that. There'll be more information forthcoming from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who administers the funds for the BP spill.
And we don't know yet what that outcome will be. But there is an acknowledgement then, though, that there is a need to research what's going on with the loons.
Yes, we did document the fact that this relates back to Minnesota loons. And we do have to give some thanks to Senator Amy Klobuchar, because she called a meeting in May of 2010 to say, what did that oil spill do to our migratory birds that may have been in the Gulf? And that initiated a series of meetings and studies that said, okay, well, we think the two birds most likely to be affected were loons and pelicans. And so we've done studies on both of those thanks to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund that were made available to us, $651,000 over those 7 years to study the impacts to justify any remediation efforts.
Carol Henderson is our guest. You can join our conversation at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. He can take your questions about wildlife and birds and so forth. Becca in St. Paul, thank you for waiting.
Hi, Carol. This is Becca calling from the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources.
Good morning.
Hi, and as you know, the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, the LCCMR, makes recommendations to the state legislature on how the state's Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund dollars are spent. And it sounds like others got the questions to you ahead of me, so I just mostly want to thank you for your incredible leadership and service to Minnesota's Environment and Natural Resources. It's been a wonderful partnership with you over the last 30 years. And it's been a privilege to fund some of your wonderful work, including some of that non-game wildlife program, your lakescaping for wildlife and water quality, your promotion of Minnesota wildlife tourism, connecting youth with nature, and also the project you were just talking about, the assessing contaminants to Minnesota's loons and pelicans. So thank you for the legacy that you have left for us all.
Thank you so much.
Back to the phones. Norm in Leech Lake, you're on with Carol Henderson.
I have a cabin on Leech Lake, and in the last 10 years, I've seen trumpeter swans that I've never seen before, sandhill cranes, and wild turkeys. On the other hand, it's rare that I see a rough grouse anymore. Do the wild turkeys have any effect on the population of the grouse?
Yeah, there you go.
That is a really intriguing question. I'm not aware of any direct competition, but I think you've raised a really interesting question, because some of the buds and other things that the grouse eat, I'm not sure that that turkeys would be eating that. They would be more directed at mast. Like this year, we're having an incredible acorn crop. I'm sure the turkeys are doing well with that. So there would be some interesting differences in terms of the types of fruits, for example, that the grouse eat. You know, they'll eat the buds, and they maybe you know, able to stand on trees and limbs that are too slender for the turkeys to use. So I don't know if they're depending on foods found on the ground that the turkeys might be foraging on, but right offhand, I'm not aware of any apparent conflict. I think the big mystery with grouse is that they go through these 10-year cycles, which kind of defy our really understanding what makes them tick.
We still don't understand a lot of what these birds and wildlife do.
And being up with a significant part of our state in that boreal ecosystem, we have a number of species, snowshoe hares, grouse, and other species, the voles, that go through these dramatic flip-flops in numbers, lynx, for example.
Right.
And I did an article on lynx one time that talked about how in each decade, in the year ending in 2, that was about when things would peak, and then in the year ending in 7, that's when they would bottom out.
How did you figure that out?
Well, Dave Meach, the wolf researcher, has been keeping records on lynx observations for many years. And I wrote an article for the Minnesota Conservation Volunteer called The Lynx Link.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to figure out what these patterns meant, because in some decades there was no spike in numbers. It was just kind of flat across the board for 10 years. And then the next time there'd be a spike. And within 1 or 2 years of the year ending in 2, there'd be a peak. You know, 1 year with the snowshoe hares, and the year after that, a peak with the lynx. So it was a fascinating
That's
relationship.
Really interesting. Let's go to John in Hastings. You're on with Carol Henderson.
Hi. I had a question years ago. While up in the Boundary Waters, we were on a lake called Ruby Lake, and there were thousands of freshwater jellyfish in the lake. And I couldn't find much about them, how they got here, where they're from, how do we combat them? I was just curious if the guests knew anything about that.
Have you ever heard of freshwater jellyfish?
No, I think that's out of my league. We would have to find another biologist at the DNR that might be able to address that. But if you wanted to send a note in directed to me at the DNR, I could forward that and we could maybe get you an answer.
Right. Well, you know, Carol, we haven't talked a lot. We haven't talked at all about your books and your articles, your photography. You have a new book out. Backyard bird feeding?
Yes. The latest book I co-wrote with two other authors is called Feeding Wild Birds in America. It was with the Texas A&M University Press. And it traces the history of bird feeding traditions in America from the 1880s all the way up to the present. And it's been just fascinating to see how this trial and error backyard effort to help wildlife has evolved over the years. And you come away with several things. One is that we love feeding the birds. Sometimes people spend many hundreds of dollars a year feeding the birds. The conservation message here is that there are probably no more than 30 bird species out of the over 400 known in Minnesota that regularly come to bird feeders, and often those are the most adaptable birds. So I had one person tell me one time, well, I didn't give anything to the non-game checkoff year last year because I spent $200 feeding the birds in my backyard. And I was kind of put off because I was thinking, no, wait a minute. Our program works on the birds that don't come to your feeders. They need good natural habitats. They need protection and so forth. And so a good conservationist can have fun feeding the birds, but we also need work and donations to support the other species. And the other bottom line was that we had a whole chapter about the use of industrial hemp as a bird food from the 1880s up to the 1940s.
In Minnesota.
Well, nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And people loved it. The doves loved it. In fact, the American goldfinch used to be called the hemp bird because it liked it so well. It's high in oil, very nutritious. And then, of course, hemp went south with the problems with THC and marijuana. Well, now Minnesota has a new program, a pilot program, for trying out industrial hemp for a variety of uses related to both human cosmetics, foods, and livestock supplements and feeds. And we discovered that they didn't know about this history of the bird food. So we're working on a strategy right now with the Department of Agriculture looking at the potential for adding the bird food element as another legitimate use for bird feeding. And we should have a news release coming out within the next several weeks, working with several conservation partners to let people know where we stand with that. But that would be a crop that farmers could grow in Minnesota, locally grown crop. It doesn't require insecticides or pesticides, and it just needs lots of nitrogen. And it was grown successfully here during World War II as a crop for producing fiber for ropes.
Right, and that's your latest book. So what are you going to do in retirement? We have about 3 minutes left.
Well,
you're just going to go look for more birds?
I'll probably look for some. My wife and I, Ethel and I, are leading a group to Colombia, west of Bogota, in January. That'll be our first trip into Colombia, and it'll be exciting to see what kind of wonderful birds will come to that we'll see in the forest there. And we'll be doing more traveling locally as well. And I'll also be adopting a new unofficial voluntary position as a conservation director for the Minnesota Ornithologists Union. So I'll be able to take some of my favorite projects with me and keep active through the Minnesota Ornithologists Union. And I think that's, you know, I don't want to just pull the plug on this because there are too many things that, you know, like these issues with lead and loons and the Heart of the Bog birding trail that need to go forward. And I'd like to be working with them long enough to just keep that going.
What did you aspire to as a young boy growing up in Iowa? Did you ever imagine a life like this?
Probably since I was about five. My parents provided me with lots of bird books. I remember my dad taking me out to a cornfield one time to show me a killdeer nest. And then I went out every day until I finally found the baby killdeers hatching, which was just incredible. My grandpa Holland took me down to his basement one day and we built a wren house. I got to paint it, and we put it under the eave of our garage out at our farm near Ziering, Iowa. And within days, the wrens moved in and raised a family. And I was just totally hooked on wildlife from, you know, kindergarten and on. And it just has moved with me through all the years. And then I had the benefit when grad school that I got to work with two incredible people, Dr. Eugene Odom, who is an ecologist, and also Dr. Dan Jansen, University of Pennsylvania, who was an entomologist working in Costa Rica. And both of them were the kind of mentors that you just really appreciate. They both went on to win the Crawford Prize, which is the biologist's equivalent of the Nobel Prize. So they were an incredible inspiration as well.
And we have just a minute left. Where do you think the big story is in conservation? Is it climate? Is it habitat?
I think it's more habitat-based. We need to do things that are more hands-on. We need to keep people involved with hands-on activities, and we also need to keep the funding going. We need to keep reminding people, look for that loon on their state tax form, remind their tax preparer, because we can multiply that money two or three times over if we get that initial donation, and that's just a really important part for keeping our program going. And then what we want to do is be the catalyst to work with other conservation partners and the LCCMR and other organizations so that we can continue to provide benefits throughout the state.
Carol, thank you so much, and congratulations on a great career.
Thank you.
Carol Henderson, non-game wildlife program supervisor for the Minnesota DNR, retiring this year after 44 years. This is NPR News.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.